It's May the 24th. We continue with our Creation Chumash class on page 210. And we're in the middle of the story of Yehuda and Tamar. We have a jam-packed class tonight, and as we said, it's a little bit abridged, so we're going to have to try to really fit everything. We're going to do our best to try to finish the story tonight, since Yehuda and Tamar plays such an integral role with Shavuos, with Rus, right, which is the next step in the story, and so we need to really try to get the story
maybe
complete.
Maybe we'll take a whole question for the answer.
Yeah, we'll take one very quickly, but only if it's...
I think Yehuda married before he married...
Yeah, but his wife died.
No, before he married her.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, it says his wife died. No, not before he married Tamar, before he married...
The daughter of Shua? It doesn't say he was married.
Doesn't?
No. Okay. Now, we left off... We had discussed the financial deal that Yehuda had made with Tamar, that she asked him for payment, and he said he would send a goat. We discussed that last week, mm-hmm, how the goat was tapping in to the power of Rivka Imenu, and how Tamar was doing that as well with the tzi'if, with the kerchief, with the veil. And we said then that... She agreed to the deal, but only if Yehuda would give her a collateral. And then Yehuda said, okay, what collateral? And she named three things, and the way they translate the three things here are...
Signet, wrap, and staff.
Okay, the signet meaning the ring, his wrap, and his staff. Okay. And then we know that after it was over, then Yehuda, starting with Pasuk Chaf, verse 20... We read this last time. We didn't have a chance to complete the thought over here. It says, "Vayishlach Yehuda eskedihu izim biyad re'ehu ha'adulami." Yehuda sent the goat with his friend the adulami. Lakacha so'ei ravon miyado isha, to take the collateral from the hands of the woman. V'lo mitza'ah, and he did not find her. We pointed out last time that Yehuda's intent was to get back the collateral. It wasn't so much to pay the price; it was to get back the collateral. And his friend asked the people of her place, saying, "Where is the prostitute that was on the crossroads where you could see her?" And they said, "There never was a prostitute here." So he returned to Yehuda. And he said, "I didn't find her." And also the people of the place said, "There never was a prostitute here. There never been one." Vayomer Yehuda, so Yehuda said, "Tikach la, let her keep it, let her keep the collateral. Pen and yeh lavuz, lest we be," they translate it as a laughing stock. Lavuz means degraded, we'll be shamed, right? Hine shalem, in other words, as Rashi says, the simple meaning is, if you keep asking, then people are going to wonder what's going on over here, and they're going to realize that what I did, and they're going to degrade me. Hine shalachti es hagedi hazeh, behold, I sent this goat, ve'atolo mitzalsa, and you didn't find her. So, what is the importance of this particular collateral, the three things, the signet, the wrap, and the staff? What is the significance of the collateral? And what is so important over here? The Torah has to spell out all the details. He went, he couldn't find her, he asked them people, they said there never was a prostitute here. He comes back to Yehuda, he tells her. And I want to focus especially in Pasuk Chaf Gimel, verse 23. Yehuda says, let her keep it. Pen niye lavuz, lest we become a laughing stock. Who's we? We? Who's we? Now you could have said it's the royal we, mm-hmm, but right away after that he says, "Hine shalachti hagadi hazeh, behold, I sent this kid. I sent the goat. V'atalam etzasa, you didn't find her." So what's we will become a laughing stock. It's hard to say that the royal we, because then he switches to the singular.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it could mean he and the messenger.
Okay, so I always assumed that's what it was. It was he and his friend. the Dulami, Chira, who is the one who's bringing the payment. So we will be the laughingstock.
Could be him and Tamar.
So I suspect that a possible answer is that. That the plural is he and Tamar, because they'll become a laughingstock. Because what kind of business is this? He sends it, she's not there. She never was there. What kind of a... They're both going to be a laughingstock.
Well, Tamar is not known to anyone except...
So how could she be a laughingstock? Right.
Tamar is not.
How could she be a laughingstock if nobody knows who she is? Right. Okay. So let's review something we mentioned last time, and let's tie it in with what's going on over here.
How about Clint? It's a real cool question. Why does he use the word Kadesha? It has the same shorish as Kadosh.
Mm-hmm.
But
Kadosh means separate. That's what Kadosh means. Usually it means it in a positive way. Holy, which means separate, not mundane, separate from the mundane. But the Torah uses the word Kadesha or Kadesh when it refers to a prostitute. Separate, meaning separated, designated for this purpose, mm-hmm. not amongst the rest of the people.
Didn't you say last week that they were put together because of some push? So if that's true, then the laughing we would mean that maybe in Shemayim they're mm-hmm. going to be laughing at the two of them because they were supposed to be together.
Okay, that's interesting. Remember that Yehuda did not want to be involved in this action, and the reason why he did it, as we pointed out last time, is the confluence of various details, the fact that here this woman was in either the Ma'aras HaMachpelah, or she was in the Eshel Avram, but she was in a holy place, which was very unusual. The fact that Yehuda was trying to avoid her and was being pushed from above towards her. The fact that Yehuda understood that there was an element of royalty that had to come from him that so far had been a failure, and there is, he was going to shear his sheep. Sheep is is always associated with Bechor, with the firstborn, which is association of royalty as well. And he understood that what was about to happen was significant, something to do with the future offspring that would be Malchus, that would be royalty. Yehuda suspected that there was something very great going on over here, and he was right. With this union with Tamar comes Peretz, from whom will eventually come David HaMelech 10 generations later. Yehuda knows that. He knows there's something very important going on over here. He doesn't know who this woman is, but he knows that there is something very important going on over here that is greater than he is. And so he agrees to the push from heaven and goes through with it. What adds to Yehuda's suspicion that this is what is going on is because when he offers the goat, she says, but then you have to give a collateral. And remember we pointed out last time, he doesn't offer a collateral. He says, what collateral would you like? Because Yehuda is testing her. He wants to see, what is she after? What is going on over here? And she asks for the signet ring, the wrap, and the staff. She hits the jackpot. These three things are the three things that Yehuda has with him that are symbols of royalty. The signet ring, as we know from Achashverosh, the ring that the king signs into law, his decrees, that's the ring that people die and live by. The wrap was it wasn't his regular clothing, because he couldn't give her that which she had to wear home, but it was an additional wrap that was he put over himself as a royal garment, and the staff was the staff of royalty. The Baal HaTurim writes that this staff is the very same mateh, the very same staff that later would be used by Moshe and Aaron to perform all of the great miracles in Egypt. This is the same staff. These are the things that Yehuda had that were indications of royalty. When she asks specifically for those three things, not more and not less, that seals the deal for him. That says to him, this is all about royalty. And so he gives them to her. Then, when he sends the kid, why is he sending the goat? To get back those items. He wants the items back. When she's not around, he says, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. Who's we? Again, he doesn't know who she is, but he is aware that, in all likelihood, this woman will become pregnant and will bear a child. And that child is going to be the father of royalty. And so, the we is himself and this woman who will eventually be revealed. He doesn't know who the woman is yet. But somehow they're going to find out either the woman or her son will eventually be known. And if you, he says to his friend, you keep going back there and asking and talking about it, then we will become laughingstocks because no one's going to know what's going on over here. What, she was there, she wasn't there. What's the whole story? It's a bizarre story. We know it's a bizarre story. And we're reading it from in hindsight, and it's a bizarre story. And so Yehuda says, let her keep it. Let her keep the items of royalty, lest we become the laughingstock. I've sent the goat, and she wasn't there. Now, in this, with this backdrop, it becomes now even more striking that when Tamar is discovered to be pregnant, which is the next part of the story we're about to read, Yehuda has no idea that it was he who lived with her. He doesn't know who she was. He didn't know it was Tamar. And even when it's discovered that she is pregnant, it does not occur to him, maybe this was the woman. And remember, he's waiting for someone to all of a sudden be expecting a child, and then a child to be born. He knows that's about to happen, and the timing is correct, but he has no idea that it's Tamar. Almost as surprising as it is, when the brothers are later on going to be in Egypt, and they're talking to Yosef, and they have no idea that it's Yosef. We, as the readers, know that it's Yosef, but they, when you're not thinking along those lines, it's too surprising to even consider that it's Yosef. Here, too, it would have been too surprising that it was Tamar, because remember, in Yehuda's mind, Tamar was evil. Right? Remember, in his mind, Tamar, who appears to be this wonderful, righteous woman, has essentially been the cause of the death of his two older boys, who also appear to be very righteous men. We said a couple of sessions ago that Er and Onan, Yehuda's sons who had died, and Tamar, the three of them, all appeared to be exceedingly righteous. But, nevertheless, Er and Onan died. And we said that one could draw one of two conclusions. Either both Er and Onan were evil, secretly, which was the truth, or that Tamar was evil secretly. Well, if your choice was that two of them coincidentally were evil secretly, or she by herself was evil secretly, then the good money would have it that she was the evil one secretly. So Yehuda has no reason to suspect that it is Tamar with whom he has lived, because Hashem would never push him towards Tamar, since Tamar is not really a righteous woman. In the end, of course, he's going to realize that he was wrong, and that Tamar is the righteous woman, and it was Er and Onan who, in fact, were the sinners. But he doesn't know that right now. Now let's go on and read on page 212. Vayehi kimishlosh chodashim. It was about 3 months. Tamar's pregnancy was accelerated. She had twins. And so naturally, twins would be accelerated. So it wasn't actually 3 months, it was about 3 months. Vayugad Yehuda lemar, was told to Yehuda saying, Zansa Tamar kawasacha, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been licentious. She's committed harlotry, they say. Vagam hinei hara liuznunim, and she's even become pregnant. She's conceived through her harlotry. Vayomer Yehuda, so Yehuda said, Hotziuha v'sisareif, take her out, and she shall be burned. Now, where does Yehuda have the authority to do that? So Chazal tell us, Yehuda, who was still the head of the tribes, who sat at the head of the Beis Din. Yehuda was the chief, he was the chief justice. And when the court case came before him, he ruled that she must be put to death, and the method of putting to death is through burning. Now let's stop for a moment and examine the method of putting to death over here. It's never pleasant to talk about these sorts of things, but let's remind ourselves: the Torah prescribes 4 types of capital punishment that is carried out by the courts. Of course, there are many other types that are carried out by God, but the types carried out by the courts, there are four. Stoning, burning, strangulation, and beheading. Those are the four. The four are performed very, very rarely, extremely infrequently. It would take all kinds of witnesses and proof in order to actually carry out the death penalty, but it was done on occasion. Normally, for this sort of sin, a woman, a married woman, who commits adultery, the punishment would not be burning, the punishment would be strangulation, would be chenek, strangulation. However, if the woman is the daughter of a Kohen, and she was engaged but not married, engaged meaning they had had kiddushin, she was betrothed, but they hadn't gone through chuppah yet, then the punishment is burning, because there is a higher expectation of the daughters of a Kohen over other daughters of Israel.
Is it actual burning?
So the Torah's prescription for burning is not burning at the stake. It is still not pleasant to think about it, but it's not nearly the same type of thing. It is a molten lead that is poured down the throat.
Oh.
Right. So you say it's a terrible thing, but it's much less painful than burning at the stake, because it burns the inside quickly, rather than the outside, which is a horrible, torturous death. But at any rate, we're not examining it now. We will eventually get to those many years from now as we go through the Chumash, when we get to the Torah command of capital punishment. We can discuss the four types of capital punishment and the pros and cons, and how, in fact, they are better than the methods that our secular fellow human beings have used in the past and even the present. Yes.
Two questions. Number one. Having Yehuda lost the respect of the brothers.
So he had. We did learn that he was diminished in the eyes of the brothers, which is true. But he was still a great sage.
But he was still in charge.
He was still in charge enough that he was the head of the Beis Din. He was the head. He was still the supreme justice.
So they did respect his.
His ruling.
His ruling.
Right. Correct. That is correct. But here, in this case, though, Tamar was not a married woman. She was tied to Shelah, to Yehuda's third son, who was waiting, she was waiting for him for Yibum, for the levirate marriage, which is the brother marrying the widow of his brother who died without children. That is not punishable by death. That is not a capital crime. That is a sin if a woman who is waiting for a brother then goes and lives with somebody else. That is a sin, but it is not punishable by death. So over here, Yehuda ruled that because what she did was egregious, therefore he condemned her to death, which the Jewish courts have the right to do that. The Jewish courts have the right to make an example out of someone in order to prevent future licentious behavior. And that was done at certain times, and it could be done to a man, to a woman, makes no difference. They have sweeping powers. Here, Yehuda was exercising that right to put her to death. The reason why he chose the method of death to be burning as opposed to strangulation is because Tamar was the daughter of Shem, as we pointed out, and Shem, as the Torah tells us back in Parshas Lech Lecha, Shem, Noach's son, was a Kohen. Now, and so since she was the daughter of a Kohen, therefore that was the method of death that he used.
Now she was with child, so that would be killing the child as well.
Right. The Torah never takes that into account. Mm-hmm. A pregnant woman, if she is condemned to death, we do not wait for the birth of the child. The woman is put to death immediately. We never, ever have the absolute atrocity of a death row. That is the most cruel institution that this country has ever come up with. To have someone sitting knowing they're going to die for days and days and months and years is one of the most cruel things that anybody's ever conceived of. We never have that. The death is done immediately within 24 hours.
Yeah, but people on death row have been proven innocent too.
So that's true, but the vast majority have not, and they have no life. They are all despondent, and it's a horrible, horrible place to be. Mm. At any rate, life imprisonment is not that much better. Now, the... that's why he condemned her to death. Now,
like you said, condemning by strangulation is when she's the daughter, person is the daughter.
No, that would be any married woman. The daughter of a Kohen would get burning. So that's why he condemned her to this. Now, we all know the story is going to end happily. It's not going to happen. But it's important to note what the death would have been, because it's going to make a significant difference for what we take out of the story, as we'll see. Now, the next pasuk, Chaf Hei 25, He mutz eis, she was being taken out, v'hi shalcha el chamiha lemar, she sent to her father-in-law saying, Le'ish asher eile lo anochi hara, to the man to whom these belong, I am pregnant. Which means, who was the one who had me conceive? It is the man who owns these things. Vatomer, and she said, Ha kerna, recognize, please, or now. Lemi hachosem es papasilim amateha eila. To whom are this signet ring, this wrap, and this staff? So she presents the collateral that she had, and she says to Yehuda, whose are these? Now, she did not say, Yehuda, look at this. Right? She never did that. She didn't pull out the shocking evidence during the court case. That's not what she did. And turn the tables on the Chief Justice. Instead, as she's being taken out to death, she sends these to him. The next pasuk says, Vayakir Yehuda, Yehuda recognized. Vayomer, he said, Sadka mimeni, she was more righteous than me. That's one way of translating the pasuk. Ki al kein lo nisatiha l'sheila v'ni, for I did not give her to Sheila, my son. For lo yasaf o l'data, and he did not, he was not with her anymore. Some say it means that he did stay with her from then on. We'll discuss that in a moment. So, she sends him these items, and then he admits the crime. It wasn't really a crime, as we'll see. It wasn't a crime, but he admits that he was the one, although it was embarrassing for him to admit it. The Medrash says over here that when she was being taken out to be put to death, why'd she wait so long? Why didn't she present them to Yehuda and say, whoever these... She didn't want to accuse him. All she wanted to do was say, whoever these belong to, that's the one. You find the one who owns these things, then you know who the father is. But that's not what... But she didn't do it right away. She did it on her way to be put to death. Why? So the Medrash says, because she couldn't find them. They were lost. She had them, and then when she was going to present them, they were lost. The Medrash says she lifted her eyes to the heavens, and she said, Hashem, please, show me, open my eyes, and show me where these things are. These three Adim, these three witnesses that I did not sin, show me where they are. And in so doing, I will have three descendants who will proclaim your name. And Hashem then showed her where they were, and she presented them to Yehuda.
They were lost.
Doesn't say someone took them. They were lost. She couldn't find them. Like losing your car keys. She couldn't find them.
Can't find my house.
Right. Now,
where is it?
Right. Now, what happened over here? What happened to these things? And what is it? What does she mean? The three people will come from her that will proclaim God's name. We know that in the future there are going to be three people who would also be condemned to the fire. Only actually being burned in a fire. And they would proclaim God's name and be thrown into a fire. And they are? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, after the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, we're talking about 1,000 years after this point, more than that. After the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, it's more like 1,300-1,400 years from this point, they will be taken to Bavel. They will be in... Actually, it's right before the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. They went into Galus along with Yechezkel and Daniel and Mordechai and Esther before the destruction. But at any rate, at that point, Nebuchadnezzar, the evil king, made a decree that everyone must, that every country, every nation who he subjugated, had to appoint representatives, and those representatives would have to bow to an idol whenever there was a particular announcement made. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were the Jewish representatives. They were there with all the other people in this huge hall, and the time came to bow, and they refused to bow, and they stood upright, and the punishment for not bowing was to be thrown into a furnace. And the three of them were taken and thrown into the furnace. And the Pasuk tells us in Sefer Daniel that the Malach, Gavriel, came and cooled off the fire, and they were saved, they were spared, they came out alive. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were of the royal family. They were direct descendants of Tamar, of this union with Yehuda. And Tamar says to Hashem, spare me my three witnesses, show me where my three witnesses are, and from that will come these three who will proclaim God's name. Now how did she know that there would be three who would proclaim God's name? And why were the witnesses missing in the first place? Why did that happen? We've talked before how the Satan works overtime to undermine the line of David HaMelech, of the royal line amongst the Jewish people. The fact that they were missing, that these three witnesses were missing, means that she could have been killed, along with her unborn twins. And that was the line of David HaMelech. What that means is, it was needed, there needed to be another merit that would spare her, that would then create the Davidic line. And there are several merits that happen right here in this story. Three things come together at one time that all are instrumental in creating the Davidic line. Number one, and this is the most significant one, is that Tamar says, and we learn it from here, it is better to have yourself thrown into a fiery furnace and don't embarrass someone publicly. That is learned from here. Tamar says, I will not embarrass Yehuda publicly. I will present him with the evidence. If he chooses to admit, then fine. And then I'll be spared. If he chooses not to admit, then I will be killed. And I will not embarrass him publicly. This is Tamar's incredible self-sacrifice that supersedes almost any other self-sacrifice we've learned about. That Tamar is willing to give herself up even though she knows she's right. She knows that she's perfectly righteous. You have to remember, not only is she giving herself up, but she would have died a sinner's death. She would have been killed, and everybody would have said, it's a good thing she's been killed. She was a sinner. She deserved to die. That's what people would have said. So her name was besmirched, and she was being put to death for it. But she said, I am happy for that to happen, rather than the alternative, which is that I should cause someone else to be shamed publicly. Yehuda wasn't doing something evil. Yehuda didn't know that he was doing anything wrong. He thought the evidence was pretty airtight that she did something terrible. She did a sin, and she deserved to die. This is not someone who's out to get you, who's evil, that you say, you know, let him kill me and I won't embarrass him. Of course, if someone's out to get you and is an evil person, of course you should get them. If you can save yourself, you should get them first. Embarrass them, hurt them, whatever you can to save yourself. But in this case, Yehuda was acting out of purity. He didn't know any of the circumstances of why she should be innocent. The evidence pointed to the fact that she was guilty. And so she says, I will not embarrass him. That's one incredible merit that comes about. It is in that merit that the Davidic line comes into existence. The second incredible merit that comes about, that brings us about, is that Yehuda, when presented with the evidence, admits.
He doesn't deny it.
It would have been so easy to deny it. No one would have known. No one would have known. And Yehuda would have walked away scot-free.
And this Tamar is a liar and she's evil. Anyway.
And she's dead. Who would have known? The only one who knows would have died. And that's it. Yehuda could have walked away. And you have to remember, he's the chief justice. He's looked at as the great sage the incredibly pious, holy man. And here he has to admit that this woman has conceived from him. And here he almost put her to death. It's very hard to look that bad, even if you try really hard. It's very difficult to look that bad. And Yehuda here had to grapple with his own dignity, his own reputation, which would certainly be dragged down, and would certainly he'd get the snickers of all the people around him by admitting it.
Do you think he did it for this?
So the Medrash says that Yehuda said that it is better that I embarrass myself in this world, rather, which is fleeting, rather than be embarrassed for eternity in the next world. Because he'll have to live with this the rest of his life, and when he dies, he will then be embarrassed in the next world. He said, better to feel the pain of the fire in this world. He meant the fire of shame, that burning shame in this world, which is a fleeting flame, rather than feel the shame in the next world. And he said that why is this happening to me? Tamar used those fateful words, haker na, recognize, please. Those are the exact same words that Yehuda used just a few pages ago when they took the tunic of Yosef and dipped it in blood. And then back on page 206, Yehuda and the brothers, but remember Yehuda was the leader, in verse 32, they say, we found this. And they say, haker na, they said to Yaakov, recognize now. Please recognize, is this your son's tunic or no? The same words. When Tamar uses those words, they hit Yehuda like a lightning bolt. And he says, that's why this is happening to me. Because I use those words to make my father have pain. Now it's being used on me. And because of that, he admitted. And that's partially why his name is Yehuda. Yehuda, Hoda'a, means to admit. And Yehuda was true to his name and admitted what he had done. I'll get to your question in a moment. In the end, what he did was not a sin either. Because in the end, what he did was a form of levirate marriage. I mentioned this to you a couple weeks ago when we discussed Yibum levirate marriage. That after the Torah is given, the only way for that to happen is for a brother to marry the widow. If there's a brother, so a man dies, God forbid, without children, and there is a brother, that brother can perform Yibum, the levirate marriage. No other relative can. But before the Torah was given, the idea, the concept of the levirate marriage applied not only to brothers, but also to immediate male relatives like the father of the deceased. That would also have worked. And so Yehuda essentially was doing Yibum. He didn't realize he was doing Yibum, but that is what was happening. Tamar understood what was happening. Tamar knew that it was Yibum. That's why Tamar did it without any concern that what she was doing was incest. Because she's, in fact, marrying her father-in-law, which is normally prohibited. But because this was a form of Yibum, it was permitted. And that's what happened in retrospect. But Yehuda didn't know it at the time. And here he's admitting to having done what he did. The third thing that comes about over here, the third merit that creates the Davidic line, is that Tamar says to Hashem that she davens and says, please provide me with my three witnesses, because if by doing so, you will then have three of my descendants who will sanctify your name. That is the third merit. So what the Medrash is telling us is that there were three things that came together. Tamar's unwillingness to embarrass somebody publicly, Yehuda's willingness to admit, and finally the fact that there would be descendants who would sanctify God's name publicly. Those three things come together, and it is through that the Davidic line is formed. Nothing less could have created the Davidic line. We have to remember, any time we're dealing with the Davidic line, whether it's this story, whether it's the story of Rus on Shavuos, which we'll be reading in just a few days, or whether it's the story of David and Bathsheba, we have to understand that the standard that they're all being held to is incredibly high. Because when it comes to the Davidic line, nothing short of these incredible types of merit will create the Davidic line. Anything less than this is simply not enough. And when we daven for Mashiach to come, this is what we're davening for. Mashiach showing up is not just some guy saying, oh, you know what, I'll just redeem the Jewish people. We're talking about an unbelievable merit that we need to have for such a man to appear on the scene. And that's what we're talking about over here. This is the type of self-sacrifice that the ancestry of David has to demonstrate, and certainly in the future, in order for their Mashiach to be born and to redeem us from our current exile, the self-sacrifice of the mother of royalty will be the same as with Yehuda and Tamar, and also the story of Ruth and Boaz. And when you study the story of David and Bathsheba, which we have not done, and I keep saying eventually sometime we'll learn that story, that's the issue over there. What's going on in that story is that David HaMelech falls short of this standard. What he does there is not actually a sin in our sense of the word, but what's going on over there is that he shoots for that high standard and falls just short, just shy of that standard. And that's why over there was a failure. And that's the whole story in and of itself. But this is the standard that we're shooting for. I will take just a couple of questions and we need to move on to finish up. Are you first there?
Yes, you said that actually Tamar lost her attributes. So it's not just when she betrayed was. So it's not such a big merit from her side. She lost and she couldn't represent them during trial, so then Hashem helped her.
But she had to daven for it. That's the thing. She had to daven. She said, Hashem, bring me those three witnesses, and then I will have three descendants who will. And she essentially had to give something else to Hashem. She had to give up more. And that's what she was willing to do. She said, save me, and in my place I will have three descendants who will be thrown into the fire to sanctify your name. Yeah.
In the chapter 18 where the forbidden relationships are listed, it doesn't say anything about, except for Yibum. It doesn't say for...
Right, it doesn't mention Yibum there at all.
No, but...
Even with a brother, it doesn't mention it.
Yeah,
it's, Yibum is a separate parasha in the Torah.
I know, but it's funny that... And the other question is, I don't really understand why Yehuda offers her a goat. It seems...
We talked about it last week. He's tapping into the goat with Rivka.
I mean, it's a self-inflicted...
Yeah, I can't go back to it now. Okay, I can't. We gotta stick to this topic. Yeah.
The question was, this rod, the rod that Yehuda has, what's the background behind that rod? How did that become the rod?
We'll have to leave that for when we get to... Yeah, good question. Well, there is a story behind it. Maybe when we get to it with Moshe and Aaron, we'll discuss it. Yes, Mark.
One last thing. Didn't Yehuda have three sons?
Yes.
And Tamar did what she did because Yehuda wouldn't give the third son to...
Correct.
So how can Yehuda turn around and say that she was an evil person? The chet fell upon him because he wouldn't give his third son to...
You're right, but in his mind, she was responsible for the death of his two older sons. He said, I don't want to give her Shelah because she'll kill him too. Not physically kill him, but
the son didn't consummate the marriage.
Nobody knew that. See, we discussed this 2 weeks ago. If you read the verses, you can listen to the classroom. If you read the verses, you'll see no one knew other than Tamar herself and God. But it was totally unknown. It was a private matter. No one knew why Er and Onan had died. Okay, now let's just finish up. We have a few more minutes. Starting with Pasuk Chaf Zayin, verse 27. It was the time that she gave birth. Oh, excuse me, just one moment. The end of the last verse, Chaf Vav 26, V'lo yasaf od ledata. There's two different ways of reading it. Either he did not stay with her anymore, which means that he never lived with her again, or that he did not go away from her again, that he took her as his wife, and they were together then until they died. So there's two different ways of reading it, and we're not going to discuss the implication of those two things right now. Chav 9:27. It was in the time that she gave birth. Behold, there were twins inside of her. The word te'omim is spelled with a vav. The word te'omim can be spelled with or without the vav. With Rivka, it was spelled without the Vav. And, excuse me, without the Aleph. Not the Vav, the Aleph. Here the Aleph is there. Over there the Aleph was not there. And Chazal tell us, because over there one was evil and one was righteous, Yaakov and Esav. Here both sons were going to be righteous, and that's why it's spelled complete. Vayihiva v'detah, it was when she gave birth, Vayiten Yod, one of the children put forth their hand. In other words, before either child came out, one of the children managed to put their hand out. Vatikacha mi'aledes, and the midwife took. Vatikshar al yodo shani leimor, and she tied on his hand a scarlet ribbon, right, a string, saying, Zeh yatzar rishona, this one came out first, in order to remember which of the twins was older, so she tied it around his hand. Vayihi kimeshiv yado, was as he removed his hand, as he pulled his hand back in, v'hinei yatzar achiv, and the oldest brother came out. Vatomer, and she said, ma paretz talecha paretz, how have you been, how they translate, strong is the literal translation? Yeah. With what strength you asserted yourself, with what strength you strengthened yourself is the literal translation. And therefore, because of that, Vayikra Shemo Paretz, he called his name, Yehuda called his name Paretz or Peretz. V'achar Yatza Achiv, and then came out his brother, Asher Yado Hashani, and on his hand was the scarlet thread, or scarlet string. Vayikra Shemo Zarach, and his name was Zarach, or Zerach. Zerach means to shine, because of the red that was around his wrist. So that is the twins that were born. Peretz is the older one, and Peretz is the one from whom King David comes. If you turn to Megillas Rus, which is also in our book over here, because we're going to be reading it this coming Shabbos, Amir Hashem, on Shavuos. If you turn to Megillas Rus on page 12,
69.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the end of it. So we're going to go to 1273, the very end of Megillas Rus. You know that Megillas Rus is the Megillah that discusses the lineage of David and how he was eventually born, with the story of Rus and Boaz. Well, so the Megillah ends off telling us the lineage of David, starting with Peretz. We just read his birth over here, and now at the end, in verse 18 on page 1273, it says, "Ve'ela tolos Peretz." These are the generations of Peretz. Peretz holidas Chetzron. Peretz gave birth to Chetzron. That's two. Peretz Chetzron. V'Chetzron holidas Ram. He begot Ram. That's three. V'Ram holidas Aminadav. Ram begot Aminadav. That's four. V'Aminadav holidas Nachshon. That's five. V'Nachshon holidas Salma. That's six. V'Salmon holidas Boaz is seven. V'Boaz holidas Obed is eight. For Obed holidas Yishai is nine. For Yishai holidas David is ten. David is the tenth generation from Peretz. Peretz is born right here on page 212 of Parshas Vayeshev. This is where he is born. We will not see that much about him in the Chumash. His name is mentioned a couple of times when the people are counted, but we have no stories in the Chumash about Peretz. Peretz is born and he lives. We don't have many stories about him. But he is the one who is the 10th generation ancestor of David HaMelech. It is not coincidental that Peretz came out the way he came out. His name, which means strength, stands for how he was born. That his brother put out his hand, but then he came forward and managed to get out first. That did not lead to strife between him and Zerach. They were not at odds with each other, unlike Yaakov and Esav, who had a similar type of thing. Who's going to come out first? Who's going to come out second? Esav comes out first, but Yaakov's holding onto his heel to try to get in front, and they're warring with each other. That didn't happen with Peretz and Zerach. Peretz and Zerach, it was simply a show of strength that Peretz came out first. That was symbolic of the line of David HaMelech, that they would be powerful and strong, and that even when it seemed that they would not be able to fulfill their mission, when the other one has his hand out at the last moment, Peretz is able to push forth and come out first. That is symbolic of the line of David HaMelech.
That's right.
And in the Gemara says that it is David HaMelech in his line that has the statement in the Gemara that says, Afilu cherev chada munachas al tavaro shel adam, even if a sharp sword is lying on the neck of a person, al yimna atzma min harachamim, he should not hold himself back from asking Hashem to save him. Even if, as long as the person is still alive, there's still breath in the person, there still is hope. That comes from the line of David HaMelech. Because even when all seems to have failed, he will burst forth with his strength. That is the line of David HaMelech. And the line of David HaMelech, throughout history, it is precariously close to being eradicated, and at the last moment, parrots. There is strength. That is a recurring theme with the line of David HaMelech throughout history.
Even in his own song.
Even in his own, and that's the story of Ruth and Boaz, that happens over and over again.
It seems like David is number 9 from parrots.
You have to count parrots. Count parrots. You know, 10. Okay.
Thank you.
Next week, Mirza Hashem, we will get back to the story of Yosef.